Hello and welcome to the Declined Estate Internet Radio Stream, the show in which we get together to discuss the ups and downs of life outside the Matrix. Declined Estate is proud to bring you one of the surprisingly few netcasts in which the hosts do not support acts of aggression against you. This will be one of our pre-recorded Sunday shows, as Rutto is currently on his way back from Vegas. The idea being that we don't take listener calls and we dive a little deeper into fewer topics in the hopes of getting to some really juicy content. Today will be especially juicy because we have a high-powered intellectual guest. And for future reference, links to both our live stream and archive episodes can be found at both inefm.com and r/declinedestate on reddit.com. I'm Ronald McPaul, casting from the Silicon Valley, and I'm going to hand it over to our handsome casters for today and let them go around the horn and introduce themselves.
All right, my turn. Just kidding. This is Eternal. How's it going?
This is James Carlin, and welcome to the podcast.
And this is Zom.
This is Wrong Opinion, coming from the Rust Belt. And we have with us today the Liberty Movement's premier karaoke artist and zombie impersonator, Bob Murphy.
Hey guys, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. We contacted you just a little over a week ago, and I got a response from you lightning quick. Do you like read through all of your emails like super fast, or do you just not get a whole lot of fan mail?
I'm trying to remember. I think it was just probably that I had a work deadline that was due, so then I, instead of doing that, I was just checking emails, procrastinating. So you probably just got lucky.
Oh, okay. Well, cool.
Yeah, well, welcome to the show. This is Bob Murphy joining us from what state are you currently located in?
I'm in Nashville, Tennessee.
Cool. What do you enjoy about that state and that general area?
I went here for a job originally, but now I'm here. I just like being here. Obviously, there's lots of great karaoke here, being Music City, and it's pretty good mix. I'm from upstate New York originally, so the weather here is pretty good, that it doesn't get too hot during the summer, but it doesn't get not too much snow during the winter, so I think it's a good mix.
How do you rank on the karaoke charts, or do we want to know?
Well, I mean, literally, when you go to the karaoke bars in Nashville, there are people that are professionals that might just be warming up before they, like, do a show or something.
Really?
But, yeah, I don't mean, like, people you would know from, like, I don't mean genuine celebrities, but I mean, like, people that go and that their job is they go and sing at bars and stuff and get paid. They might go to the karaoke bar the night before to just screw around or warm up their voice or something. But I'm pretty versatile, see, because, you know, there's people that can do country better than me, people can do other things better than me, but I kind of the whole package. So that's what I do. That's what I bring to the table.
Yeah, so they do that as kind of their warm-up. Do you have your own kind of warm-up where you go, like, out places and debate random people on economics or whatever?
I understand the premise of what you're saying, but actually, no, people are surprised when I go out. And like, I don't like to do one-on-one evangelism, so I'll be out, like, after giving a talk somewhere, and kids will, like, bring up a girlfriend and say, hey, she voted for Obama, Dr. Murphy, say something to her. And I'll just be like, you know, hey, what are you drinking? I don't really like trying to convert people on the spot.
That's understandable.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. We wanted to know, I guess, a bit of the history of the great Bob Murphy. What really motivated you to come into Austrian economics and then into the stateless society, you know, anarcho-capitalism?
Well, when I was in high school, I started reading Rothbard, and just it clicked with me. I mean, I didn't call myself an anarcho-capitalist until college. Like, at first, I thought Rothbard was too radical. He took things too far. But that was just, you know, it just takes time when you encounter something new for it to sink, I guess. So that's what happened. I don't know if you wanted me to talk about something more specifically. It was just, for me, the big stumbling block was I kind of thought that there has to be a government military to defend from foreign invasions. So then once I had convinced myself that no, the market could provide military defense, then it really wasn't hard to then embrace the full anarcho-capitalist approach.
I'm curious, how did you come across a book by Rothbard when you were in high school? Did you just accidentally find it? Because I know I had never heard of the guy until maybe a little while after discovering Ron Paul and going down the rabbit hole that way?
I'm trying to remember. My exact path was my dad listened to Rush Limbaugh, the guy, you know, the radio guy in junior high. And so he'd be, you know, picking me up from school or something and be on the car and I'd hear that. And then, and so Limbaugh used to talk about free market stuff once in a while. And then that I started, you know, that was the first time I'd ever heard these ideas that, oh, like it might, if the government tries to do something, it might give you the opposite of what it tried. Like I literally had never even heard that concept before, like let's say seventh grade. And then, I started reading that stuff, and it was like Thomas Sowell and Walter Williams were the guy, my favorites, and they were economists. And so I realized, oh, I really like this economics stuff. And I'm trying to remember how I got into Rothbard. I guess it was I got into Henry Hazlitt, and then he mentioned Mises, and probably maybe it was like a laissez-faire book club sort of brochure or something. Or I'm not sure exactly how I came across Rothbard, but yeah, it was certainly in high school.
That's pretty interesting that you kind of went through a chain of authors who were kind of like referencing each other, and that's how you went from guy to guy.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely was like, I read Milton Friedman first, and then it was pure, like from my point of view, pure and purer stuff.
Yeah. So you have a website, consultingbyrpm.com, and you offer economic consulting, and you also have written some books, and you write articles, and you also teach at the Mises Academy, which is a program that the Ludwig von Mises Institute runs. So you're a pretty busy guy by some respects. Is there any one of these that you get the most enjoyment out of whenever you work on them?
Well, I mean, all these projects have different pros and cons. I mean, the teaching obviously is good, but I reach a limited, you know, there's only a certain number of people that can sign up for a given class, but then you have somebody's attention for, you know, the hour and a half or whatever the length of the time the lecture is, so you can really concentrate a lot into that. Whereas blogging, I have a much wider audience, but it's, you know, sort of eclectic and people are tuning in and they don't necessarily agree with everything I'm saying. So it's a different approach. So yeah, I mean, it's different venues. There's different things I can talk about in the different places also. Cause I also write a lot for free market think tanks, and depending on the crowd and in the venue and what the topic is, I mean, everything is always the same theme of the free market and more individual liberty and not having government try to solve problems, if you will. But depending on the crowds, you know, I might say something that's a little bit more tame, like let's cut spending in this area, as opposed to talking about privatizing the military, which, you know, for a lot of people, that just sounds crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is there anything which you would, you know, one of these think tanks contacts you and you turn them down for a specific reason?
Sorry, can you repeat that question?
Let's say one of these think tanks contacts you, like, hey, you know, we want an article about this, or, you know, we want you to research that, and you turn them down for a specific reason. Do you run into that kind of thing?
I mean, there's a lot of times, but probably not for the reason you think. I mean, I do turn down stuff, but it's more because it's just not, it's really in my area of, like, to go do something that would require a lot of research in a particular field, and it's not my area. Like, so it's more of a technical paper. So certainly I've turned down stuff like that where it just doesn't make sense for me to, the time it would take me to learn that and to be able to produce what they want isn't worth what they could pay. As far as, if you mean things like, oh, does someone want me to write something and I don't actually agree with it? I'm trying to think, I mean, that kind of stuff does happen. I can't off the top of my head think of a specific example, but I think it's more, people come to me because they know what my perspective is. And so they, you know, if they're even talking to me in the first place, it's because they want someone to say the government shouldn't be doing X because for some reason, you know, these people don't like the government doing X in their particular, whatever their issue is. Right. So, I mean, obviously, if somebody came to me and said, hey, we think the government should raise income taxes on the top 1%, can you do an analysis supporting that? Obviously, I would say no. But I'm just saying nobody even bothers asking me that because my perspective is pretty well known.
All right. Yeah. I was going to ask a quick question. You also taught at Hillsdale College, correct, for a number of years?
I was a student there, and then I went and taught there for 3 years as a professor.
Yeah, how did you like teaching in a formal classroom setting? Did you feel it was kind of limiting? Did you like working at Hillsdale? I don't know too much about, you know, your time there, so can you share that with us and the audience?
Yeah, sure. Well, I thought I was going to be a college professor for my career, and then now I'm not. And so obviously something changed there. I really did like teaching. And since I'm so passionate about Austrian economics and economics in general, obviously a logical thing for me to do with that is to be a college professor. I mean, there's not too many places that you can do that. And I also, you know, people tell me that I'm good at expressing these hard ideas in ways that the layperson can understand. So it seems like it would be a no-brainer that I would be a college professor. But I did get a little frustrated there. I mean, there were some students that I really, you know, they really liked it and everything, and I'm still friends with them now and everything. And so that was very rewarding to when you have those students and you know that you're sort of taking them down the path that you kind of saw yourself going down when you were their age. So that was great. But on the other hand, I mean, it's just higher education in general, just the way things are. I think there's too many people that go to college. And so even at Hillsdale, which was a fairly selective school, I mean, it wasn't like Ivy League or anything, but I'm saying it wasn't like some local community college. It was a school where the parents would have to pay a decent amount for their kids to go there and everything. So these were even above average students, but a lot of them, especially at the lower level courses where it was like, you know, principles of economics, half the kids in there, they didn't care about the class. It was just they were business majors, and so they had to take an economics class, you know. And it's just it was also because I was young, and it was the first time I'd been teaching in front of kids or whatever, so it was kind of like a bad feedback mechanism where if I would go in there and get the sense that they were bored, then I'd get real apologetic and I wouldn't be all fired up, and so then it really would be a boring lecture. You know, so it was a bad mix in that sense too. But my point is just I noticed that I really loved going and teaching the upper level elective classes, you know, so the kids who are econ majors and who took, you know, my course in game theory or something where they didn't have to take it, but they took it because they either liked me or they liked the material. Those classes were great. Whereas the courses where some of the people there were forced to be there in a sense, and that one, like those, like I just would dread going into those classes, and the kids didn't end up like not liking it either. So anyway, and then as far as the academic portion, like being in academia per se and publishing articles, I got kind of disillusioned with that too, because you'd be putting all sorts of effort into this paper that, you know, you're thinking you're the scientist, and oh, there's this research and I'm advancing human knowledge in this one little area of, you know, capital theory or something like that, that I've noticed something that all the economists in human history have missed up until this point, and this is great. And it would take 2 years to get published, and then finally when it would come out, like maybe five people on Earth would read the thing, you know, and two of them would think you were wrong, and you'd think, no, I'm right. And it was just, I mean, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but my image of what being a college professor was going to be going into it was naive. And that's partly why I decided to switch to the financial sector.
Yeah, it's funny because one of my professors when I was in school said that I think the average number of readers for a paper, for like a doctorate level research paper, is like three or something. It's really funny. Like, nobody reads the things, unfortunately. Occasionally you'll get one that gets a lot of exposure, but not most of them are just done for the sake of doing them so people can get tenure and such.
Yeah, and I'm not even – I mean, I understand why the system is what it is, and I'm certainly not – I hope anyone who hears this who is at a college or something – it's not like I'm castigating the whole profession or anything. It's just I'm saying that was my experience, and it may have been partly that going into it, I had such high expectations, and I had this vision of, you know, what it was going to be like, and it just in practice it didn't feel like that's what it was.
Yeah, my dad is a college professor, and I talked to him a lot about like incentives and the reasons why people do or do not enjoy classes and why people are actually in these classes. And one of the things he has observed is that the older students, that is people who are typically 25 or older, are there because they want to be there. And also the people in his advanced classes are there because they want to be there. But, you know, speaking of incentives, the regular students, well, they're there because government, mommy, daddy, whoever gave the money, and that's what they're supposed to do. Not because they're there to learn, but because they're there for some piece of paper which is supposed to make them successful later in life.
Yeah, I mean, that was part of it that I noticed too. And I mean, the other thing, like, just to give you an example of what was just my being me being naive and whatever, is that, like, my first semester I remember teaching, and these even were the econ majors, I was teaching history of economic thought, and I would assign all, you know, I'd take all this time to sift through and grab the readings that I thought were really important, and I was, you know, old, you know, stuff from Wicksteed or Irving Fisher or whatever, and I was just pouring through all this stuff, and I'd be like, oh, wow, this is great. You know, I never read this kind of stuff. These kids are going to love this. And I just, and then the first exam would come along, and the answers would astound me. And I'd be like, how could they not know that? And I would show my wife the stuff, and I'd be complaining. And she goes, well, maybe they didn't do the reading. And then it was like, oh, and that made sense of everything. And I mean, that's how naive I was. Like, I just kind of figured if you were an econ major and the professor assigned the stuff, you would read. I mean, obviously I knew one or two kids would blow it off, but I mean, it never occurred to me that the whole class just wouldn't do any of the reading and then go into the first final and just think it'd be okay. But that is what happened. And I mean, so it's stuff like that where I was having to like treat them like they were children. Like, I didn't want to have an attendance policy. I just want to say, this is crazy. You guys are adults. I don't want to force you to come to class. If you don't want to come, don't come. But then that was silly because then kids wouldn't come, and I would, what was I going to do? Just fail half the class every exam. And that was the only way my system would work, is if I just were willing to fail everybody so they'd get serious and then do the work without me having to hold their hand. But I, you know, people would, the administration would say, why did half the class fail? That's crazy. You know, so it's, I'm just saying, I didn't like the way I had to act if I wanted to actually educate those kids at that level, because they were, in my mind, they were acting like they were in junior high when I was thinking, you guys are 18 or older. This is crazy. So that was part of it, why I kind of got frustrated.
Well, I can see why, because, you know, public schooling for years and years, they built up this expectation that, you know, you don't really have to do a heck of a lot in school. You just kind of show up and every now and then maybe turn something in. And then you pretty much, you know, just glide your way through junior high school and high school, and you get to college, and people then there's not that expectation of responsibility of having to actually keep up with the work and do the reading, of it's going to be hard grades. And so kids just aren't used to that environment. And then, you know, colleges are stuck between a rock and a hard place where they have to, like, either fail their entire class and to kick everybody out, and that sucks because they don't have people in their school that can give them money, or, you know, they make it kind of easy and the same thing, and the degree's not worth as much later, and so you end up with, you know, no-win situation. I know from my school, I went to an engineering school, and we did have, like, two-thirds of the people from freshman year on through graduation, they just dropped out of the major, if not just failed out just because they couldn't keep up. It's really tough for a lot of people, and it's because government schools really don't prepare you properly. They hold your hand way too much.
Yeah. And that's something too. I mean, when you say engineering school, if there is something where there's an objective set of skills that your graduates absolutely need to have, then I think it's easier, you know, for the school to just set those standards up, and then no one feels guilty about applying them. Whereas with me, the problem was, you know, to say, well, gee, how much history of economic thought should a major have if we're going to give them a degree from our institution? You know, that's kind of an arbitrary thing, and I wasn't confident. Again, a lot of this stuff was that I was my first time teaching too, so I really didn't know. And I showed my first exam to Guido Hulsman, actually, who, you know, is associated with the Mises Institute, is notorious for being a hard grader and everything, and expecting an unreal amount of stuff from the students. And I showed him my first exam, and he said he thought that was too hard. He was saying that, no, you're expecting way too much from the kid. So that's partly what I mean, that I went in there like thinking everyone was going to basically be like I was when I was their age, and clearly that wasn't the right mentality for me to have. So a lot of this, if I had just stayed there and been teaching for 20 years, I'm sure it would have worked itself out, and I would have known that, no, it's okay for me to push here and expect more from you guys, but on the other hand, I'm not being crazy for expecting this, whereas, you know, in the beginning there, I was feeling my way through that.
Considering all the difficulties that you've experienced, what do you think would be a good way to get, not even necessarily Austrian economics, but maybe just general economics knowledge out to the layperson and get them interested in it and help them to understand it? Because it's certainly, even if you only understand the very basic stuff that isn't controversial, I think it's an important knowledge for people to have, because they are participating in the economy. What do you think is a good way to accomplish that?
I'm sorry, I missed the beginning of the question. Can you rephrase that?
Yeah. What do you think is a good way to get the average person interested in a knowledge of economics and get them to understand it?
Well, I mean, especially with the work I had been doing with the Mises Institute, we try a broad range of things, to put it that way, because I think it's different depending on the type of person. So if you're talking about someone who's got a job and a small business or is running a household or whatever, I think the important thing is to get that person to see the relevance, to see why it is that government policies and what the Federal Reserve is doing that is responsible for what happened in with the housing bubble. And it's the reason that unemployment continues to linger on and so on and so forth. So for those kind of people, you have to sort of convince them that really it's worth your time to learn about how the Fed works, because there's a payoff at the end. You're going to now be in a better position when you're trying to figure out, what do I do with my 401k or whatever. Whereas with younger people, it's the exact opposite almost, that they don't really care about financial stuff per se, because a lot of them, depending on the age you're talking about, they don't have jobs yet, or they don't have serious jobs, and they don't have a house. They're not making mortgage payments. So a lot of that stuff just seemed like a kid in junior high or something. He doesn't really care about job creation at that point. But so that kind of kid, though, you have to show him and just get him interested in economics, just like it's a fascinating thing to study. That, oh, isn't this neat how the economy can just spontaneously organize itself, and that you don't need a bunch of people to consciously plan why there needs to be money, or that if coal all of a sudden becomes more scarce, that we don't have to have people sending orders to everyone else to tell them to use less of it, that just the market price goes up and that sends the information out automatically, as it were. So, I mean, different things like that, or and just the speeches I would give, depending on the crowd. If I'm going to give a talk to a bunch of junior high kids, it's going to be one thing. If I'm going to give a talk to a bunch of people who are in their 50s, it's certainly going to be a different kind of thing, even though in both cases, my message is basically the same, that the free market works and government intervention screws things up.
Yeah, I've noticed that your approach is more towards communicating these ideas in a way that people can understand, too. And not necessarily like, here are the technical economic things that you have to know, but more along the lines of, I'd say better communication techniques than some of the other people that I'm familiar with, you know, watching these videos. I mean, I can understand them having like a background in math and science and computers and all those technical things. But one of the things I have noticed in communicating the ideas of liberty and economics is that you really can't necessarily communicate in the same kind of technical ways that a lot of us more computerized or in-depth people understand. You have to communicate in other ways. And I was kind of curious about your thoughts on communication in general.
Well, sure. I mean, and I guess I'm just going to be saying things that are obvious. Like you say, it's important to know what the audience is. And so, you know, if someone has me come give a talk somewhere, people, like, because it happens a lot, the people will contact me, and whether it's a student group or businessmen or something like that, and they'll want me to come in and give a talk to people. I do a lot of work for people in the insurance sector. So a lot of times these insurance guys will want to get me to come give a talk to their clients or so forth. And so that's the first thing I ask when we're going back and forth over email, in terms of, they say, hey, what's the date, and this is how long we want you to go. And I always say, well, you got to describe the crowd to me. What do they know? Do they know what Austrian economics is? Do they like Ron Paul? Do they, you know, this kind of thing? Because yeah, if you show up and you just start saying stuff that everybody in the room already knows, then they're probably just going to be bored. But on the other hand, you can't just assume a bunch of stuff, or you certainly don't want to open with a joke that no one gets, because you assume that they knew something that they don't. So that's really a thing. But beyond that, I mean, it's and this is something that I'm not inventing, obviously, but you have to be excited and passionate about what you're giving the talk on, that people will sort of come around and they'll at least listen to you if it sounds like you really believe in what you're saying and you're fired up about it and you think it's important. Whereas if you get up there and because of your body language and whatever, you're conveying the fact that you either don't really believe what you're saying, or that you think that it's going to be kind of boring and you're almost apologetic and, geez, I'm sorry, we got to go over this stuff. like that just seeps through, and then it makes people just doze off, or they check their BlackBerry or whatever, and they just get, they're waiting for it to get over with. So it really, you know, I've studied it a lot, been to a lot of different events and watched other speakers, and you can just see some people when they get up there, they just boom, within seconds they take the room over, and everyone listens to them for the full hour. And other people, when they get up there, it's just agony, and you know, you're just waiting for the, when is this thing going to be over with. And it's not because one guy's smart and is saying good things and the other guy's stupid and is saying things that don't make sense. It's something different from that. And it's like a different quality altogether, different dimension. And so that's, so for people who are going to be giving talks in public, I would encourage them just study what other people are doing, because there is a method to it. You know, it's not just some random thing. And it's also not something that's in your DNA. It's not just, oh, some people have it and some people don't. That you can change what your delivery method is, and you can study other people and their techniques and get better if you're going to be communicating with people.
And definitely. I mean, that's what politicians do, isn't it? You know, just get up there and say the dumbest things possible, but capture the entire room, and people just nod their heads and agree with it anyway. Like, oh man, I'm so fired up now because you said that thing, which doesn't make any sense, but it's okay because I'm fired up.
Well, I mean, that is true, and you are right that you could. Yeah, so in one sense, you're right, and this is why I it was hard for me. Like one of the, when I went and talked at a Tea Party rally, this was back when like the Tea Party was still new, and it was open, and it wasn't clear, you know, was this like a Republican thing, or was it like a grassroots thing, or what was it? And so I went because I wanted it to be, you know, a genuine sort of smaller government thing. I didn't want it to just get co-opted by the Republican Party, and so that's partly why I went. This is a couple years ago, or 3 years ago at this point. And so, yeah, and I gave a talk in, it was in, what was it called? Fifth Third Arena, I think it was what it was. And it was in Ohio. So it was this huge basketball court, you know? And so there's a train going by. People might be able to hear that in the background. And so I have a microphone. I'm on the basketball court, and I'm literally surrounded by thousands of people in the stadium, and so, or the, yeah, in the bleachers and so forth. And so, I mean, that was a much different environment from what I was used to, because normally I'm used to giving like an after dinner talk at a hotel banquet room where I'm up on a little stage with a microphone maybe, and there's 200 people in the crowd sitting, you know, around dinner tables looking at me. That's a much different thing from being there. So it's different. And in that kind of arena, that's where like a politician type would thrive. And I would notice that the other speakers, like the ones who were really just took that place over, you're right. It was a different strategy you had to use as a speaker. And just to give you one example, the kind of thing I mean, you know, I was pretty good at giving jokes in a sort of after dinner talk environment. And there you really had to know the crowd, and you had to just do the timing had to be right and everything. But in this thing, I noticed it wasn't so much that the joke had to be right, but you just had to wait for it, or to, if it was going to be an applause line, you just had to like let the crowd know that was an applause line. So like I would say something, and I'm trying to think off the top of my head, I can't even think of what I said, but I would say something and just wait and look, and then somebody in that whole place is going to start clapping. You know what I mean? Just because if there's 6,000 people in there, chances are one guy really liked what you just said, and if you wait, one guy's going to start clapping, and then it's just a chain reaction. And so I'm just saying, like, it was a completely different environment. And whereas in an after dinner talk or whatever, if you say something and you thought it was going to be a laugh line or it was going to get applause, and you wait a couple seconds and it doesn't catch on, you have to just keep going and act like it didn't faze you that no one laughed or that no one clapped, because it's not like the room's going to spontaneously burst into applause. Whereas in this huge arena with 6,000 people, I realized I just had to wait, and someone would start clapping, and then there'd be a chain reaction. So, I mean, I'm just saying things like that, where you would think it would be the opposite. You would think it would be harder to get a crowd of thousands fired up than a crowd of 200, but it isn't. It's easier to get thousands of people all whipped up, because just the mass mentality, and if you can get some of them going, then the other people start clapping because they feel like they're just like this little drop of water on a wave, as opposed to being somebody who's in control of the room because, hey, there's only a few of us in here.
Definitely. One thing I've noticed, certainly people, when they think about economics, think a lot about like very math heavy stuff, econometrics, really kind of dry math heavy stuff in general. And I was wondering, like, does the Austrian economics, which is a little more of a, I guess it's kind of more of a sociology kind of soft, not heavy math theory behind it. It's not like these arbitrary equations that just show up. And, you know, there's really good theory, logic, you know, grounding to it. Does that draw people in a little better than, you know, the traditional neoclassical, here's your equations that use GDP and this and that?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, well, it draws in some people and then other people it repels. So obviously the people who are in Austrian economics, and if you ask them, why do you like it? You know, the lay person who's a fan of Austrian economics and says, oh, I'm an Austrian, or I follow the Austrian school, I reject the Keynesian approach. Yeah, that's a lot of times that'll be near the top of their list, that they'll say, yeah, I took that stuff in college and it was all a bunch of equations, didn't make any sense to me. Whereas the Austrians write in words and it's logical and verbal and it makes a lot of sense. And they understand that human beings are complex and they can't be modeled with these mathematical approaches and, you know, that kind of stuff. But on the other hand, there are lots of people who don't like Austrian economics. And if you ask them what's your problem with it, they'll say often one of their top complaints will be, oh, it's not very rigorous. It's not very scientific. The Austrians just run around in circles with their word games, whereas real mainstream economists who are at MIT and Harvard or whatever, and they're doing genuine research, peer-reviewed research, these guys have rigorous mathematical models behind what they're saying. You know, and Krugman will talk about that a lot too. And on his book, Paul Krugman, the famous Keynesian economist, that's one of the things he'll use to beat down some of his opponents, is he'll say, I have a model. What do you guys have? You know, and he's very proud of the fact that the words he spits out in support of policies, if push comes to shove, he can produce a mathematical model with all these bells and whistles. You know, so in the world of that model, the recommendations he's giving to the government make the people in that model better off. And so Krugman thinks he's got a pretty airtight demonstration, whereas the people that are against him on that issue, he thinks they're just ideologues and political, and they really can't back up what they're saying with a scientific approach. So you're right that I think that in economics the Austrian approach is the one that's correct, whereas the guys who try to take the method from physics and apply it to economics, because that's really what happened historically, is that the economists looked at what the mathematical physicists were doing and they thought, wow, those guys are really smart and they're real scientists and we want to be like them. And so they literally took a lot of the equations from classical mechanics and then tried to use that in models of the economy. And so I think that there's a serious problem when you do that. And, you know, methodologically speaking, that's a bad thing to do in economics, and you're going to end up getting bad results doing that. But so that's why I like the Austrian school. But it is true that a lot of people are attracted to it if you're the sort of person that doesn't like math and you're turned off by all the equations that they use in a standard economics course in college.
Yeah, we understand you have an ongoing thing with Krugman where you want to debate him. Is that right?
Right. So yeah, if your listeners are interested, it's at KrugmanDebate.com is where I summarize all the information. But yeah, I made a public challenge that I would debate him on business cycle theory. And so the trick to it is the people who want to see the debate happen just make a conditional pledge saying, you know, I'll put up $20 or whatever, but I don't get charged unless Krugman actually debates Murphy, in which case my credit card gets dinged. And so right now we've got like $77,000 pledged in that fashion where
very nice.
Krugman will debate me. And the other thing too is it goes to a food bank in New York City. It doesn't go to me or to Krugman. The money that gets pledged would go to a food bank in New York City. So that's kind of the goofy publicity stunt that I did in order to try to bring attention to this.
I would definitely pay $20 to see Krugman scramble like that.
Well, then go ahead and make your pledge.
All right. And I'm a signer for the Free State Project. And I know you've been there for the past couple years. You hosted the roast this past year. What do you think about the movement overall? And where do you think it's going to go?
Yeah, it's when I first heard about it, I was in grad school. When I first heard about the Free State Project, I thought it was a great idea. And because the people who are into the liberty movement, we're sure that our ideas are right. We know that the free society would be much more productive, prosperous, and much more peaceful, and there'd be fewer social problems and so forth in it compared to the system we have now, where the government just runs our lives in all kinds of different ways and tries to take over everything. And so then the issue is, okay, instead of us now refining the theory ever more, and we also should think about how do we get there. And so that's the issue when people have different strategies. So yeah, in grad school I certainly was very interested in it. I never actually signed it simply because I was at the time, you know, I was getting, I don't remember if I was already officially engaged or going that route, but you know, my fiance was saying, well, let's not sign that if we're not serious, because, you know, you might get a job somewhere else or whatever. And so we didn't actually sign because we didn't want to be just putting our name down if we weren't serious about it. We didn't know the future at that point.
Would you ever move up?
What's that?
Would you ever move up?
Well, right now I have a son that's in a school that's really suitable for him in Nashville. So down the road, like when he moves out and he's on his own, then yeah, I would definitely consider moving. But yeah, so right now it's more just other reasons that are keeping me in Nashville. So yeah, there is that issue. As far as telling people going to Pork Fest per se, which is the Porcupine Freedom Festival, which is sort of an offshoot of the Free State Project. So there, it's like the annual festival that they have in New Hampshire for the people who are in the Free State Project, but people from around the country go there. That for sure, I would recommend anybody who goes to sort of libertarian type events, if you've never been to Pork Fest, that's one you should definitely get on your calendar. It's in June, near the end of June usually, and that I think is that just blew me away. Like that really was the most fun sort of libertarian event that I had been to, and because the difference is the reason the Free State Project is interesting when you go there is that those people, it's not like a conference where people are in their regular lives and they go to this thing and then they go back home. This is, you get to see people and they're really living what the textbooks or whatever talk about, or we write up in our articles. And so the people who are really trying to implement it in their everyday lives. And so, you know, because they live in a community where there's a lot of people who have the same value system they do. And so that's why it's even possible to start down that path where you say, okay, we're going to settle things. If I have a problem with you, I'm not going to take it to a government court. I'm going to try to get some arbitration or, you know, things like that, where they try to solve their problems without bringing the government into it. That's, the people there are really trying to live that out. So it's very interesting to see they're taking it a step beyond just us talking about it intellectually.
And the best thing about Pork Fest, I think, is that even if, you know, the people you're talking to are not liberty lovers, you can always advertise it as a barbecue festival and really just kind of sucker them in.
Yeah, you could, but if they go there not knowing what it is, they might be a little bit surprised by what they see, because there's lots of people there that, it really is a big collection of people who take those ideas to the extreme. I mean, like, there's people walking around, you know, who are openly armed and stuff. I mean, it's all legal and everything.
It's not even just sidearms. It's like AKs and like M4s.
I'm just saying it is. It's whereas in other more academic, like typically you're not going to see some college professor walking around with a gun on his hip, you know. So I'm just saying it's funny that, you know, we write about stuff saying, because obviously libertarians are against gun laws and stuff like that, and they think free people would be responsible, whatever. But I'm just saying, just to see it, you're like, whoa, okay, this is a real deal.
Okay, what's your favorite part of Pork Fest, aside from the concentration of like-minded people?
Well, I mean, this is, of course, I'm biased here, but my favorite part are the roasts that we've done the 2 years I've been there. I mean, because I really like comedy and everything, and so that...
You're a good addition, I think.
What's that?
I said you're a good addition to the roasts. Oh, you handle it well.
Thank you. So, that's part of my point too, though, that Pork Fest is different from the traditional, it's not just a thing where students go and then there's professors who get up and lecture at you and teach you stuff. I mean, it really is an entertaining thing where, just the idea that you're going to get up and have a bunch of people in the liberty movement roasting each other. I mean, that's not something you're going to get at most other events.
Yeah. If you want the more intellectual side, they do have the Liberty Forum, which takes place in the wintertime.
Right. And also, too, I don't want to give people the wrong idea. There are intellectual type formal lectures there, and I would give them, too, when I go to Pork Fest, and they had a bunch this year from various Austrian economists. So I don't mean to be saying, oh, it's all just fun and games. But my point is, it is a different type of experience, and there's different entertaining events that occur there. It's not simply, it's not like going to summer school. I'll put it that way. It's more like going to summer camp.
Yeah. A lot of the people who go to Pork Fest and are involved with the Free State Project also identify with voluntarism. And I remember you mentioning in the past that you call yourself a pacifist, which fits under that kind of bigger umbrella. Can you tell us more about your opinions on the use of defensive as well as retributive violence, if those are at all appropriate under your version of pacifism?
Sure. So what I'm talking about is just, it's a my personal perspective on things. You know, it's so as far as like standard libertarian theory, obviously they'll say either because you think of it from natural law or for utilitarian reasons or whatever the grounding is, you'll say, okay, you can't initiate aggression against somebody. And that's what, and you know, anyone who calls himself a libertarian in the modern American sense of the term probably would endorse that view, but that still means you're allowed to use defensive force. And so if somebody is breaking into my house, then I can go get a gun and say, hey, get off my property, that kind of stuff. So me as a pacifist, though, I personally think that I'm not going to try to do that in my life, right? So it's not that I have a problem necessarily other people are doing it, but I'm saying this is what I'm going to do in my perspective. And also if I, you know, if we were in a sort of free society where there were competing agencies that would provide defensive services and protection and so on, I would definitely patronize companies that didn't have guns, for example, where if somebody is breaking into your house, they'll send people to, you know, they'll send squad cars or whatever, but the people, the employees of this firm do not use firearms. I mean, they could have body armor on and, you know, they could have nets and stuff maybe, but the point is they do not go around shooting people. And I think that would just be a much healthier system, and that over time, I mean, the London police officers didn't used to have guns, you know, and that system worked for a while, and the criminals knew that they didn't have to fear for their lives, and so a lot of them wouldn't even have guns. So I mean, it's I think that there is it's a trite phrase, but this phrase of the cycle of violence I think is accurate in a sense, in that I think instead of taking people and putting them in cages and stuff like that there's a free society would find ways of sort of rehabilitating people and discouraging antisocial criminal behavior in ways that doesn't involve us setting up a bright line and saying, if you cross this, then we're going to rain fire upon you, so to speak. We're going to unleash hell. I don't think that's the right approach, even though a lot of that would be consistent with the non-aggression axiom.
Yeah, one of the things I have noticed is my personality type is one of those people that will step in there and will physically defend another person, but that's a relatively rare attribute, and that's not necessarily to talk bad about anybody, but I think that does fit well within the division of labor and the division of specialties. You have people who are artists, you have people who are scientists, builders, plumbers, economists, and you have those kinds of unique personalities, unique capabilities, which, you know, somebody like me would, you know, be willing to like step in there and say, you know, possibly remove somebody from your property, say, hey, look, you know, play nice, we're here to make sure you don't hurt my friend Bob Murphy. And Bob Murphy is the kind of guy who would say, hey, play nice, don't steal my friend James's, you know, money out of his bank account, kind of thing. So I think there's definitely a good division of labor and division of specialties, which goes on even within the ideas of security. And I think what's his name, David Friedman, has done some, I like his work on the subject.
Yeah, and it would be the way I'm picturing it, it would be there would still be law, right? So it would still make sense to classify someone as a criminal, right? So there's some people that take stuff really far and say, you know, oh, hey, if I call myself a pacifist, it means that we just don't even judge other people in any respect, and that, you know, that we just think everything is equivalent. And if someone comes and is, you know, breaks a window in my house and climbs in and starts taking food out of my kitchen or something, I'll just go up and say, okay, here's the turkey over here, and make sure you don't miss my watch or whatever. And, you know, I'm not right now, I mean, that certain people from a religious perspective might think that's what they should do, and that's the real way to do it. And I'm not even saying that that's wrong, but my point is, by me saying I am a pacifist and I think that society would be more effective if it were organized on those principles, that's not so much what I have in mind. It's more, I think that if you did get the government out of it and it were to open up to genuine competition and market incentives, I think the actual legal codes would still allow for defensive force, right? So if someone's breaking into your property and you shoot and kill the guy, you know, it's 2 o'clock in the morning and he's in your living room and you shoot him, I think a private judge given the values that most Americans have these days in a private legal setting, I think the law would be such that you'd completely be exonerated from that. It's not that you would have just committed a crime. But I also think that over time, like just custom would evolve such that people would really try to minimize that. And for sure, if you were like a business owner and you wanted to have security, that the security wouldn't have guns. And that they would just, even for like a bank or something, I think over time it would evolve. And if you'd say, well, gee, but wouldn't the bank robbers just have guns and be unstoppable? Well, no. I mean, they could do all kinds of, you know, they could have the money in the vaults or whatever so that the cashiers literally couldn't open the vaults and things. So, I mean, there's all kinds of ways they could deal with that. And I just think it would, natural incentives would evolve so that the professionals who are in charge of containing criminals, because you're right, there would be a division of labor and there would be people who would be more suited to that, even if we're just talking about like, you know, bouncers at bars or something, they would be much less aggressive, I think, over time just because of competition and so on. And that it's just bad for business if you have, I mean, think of it this way. If there were competing security forces and one of them did what those cops just recently did in New York City, you know, where they shot a bunch of bystanders. I mean, that firm would go out of business the next day. Okay. But the reason the NYPD is still going to be in business is because they have a monopoly. And so I'm saying it's that. So it not only what I'm saying is not only would the firms now that walk around with guns be much more careful when they start shooting, I'm saying they wouldn't even have guns in the first place. I think at first one firm would say that would be an advertising point. They would say, we don't actually have guns. We use non-lethal methods of containing criminals. And I think that that would just catch on. And then so people growing up in that society would learn that violence isn't the way you solve problems. And I think you'd have less violent crime even, so that the problem you're trying to solve would get lower and lower over time because of that. Whereas right now, it's this weird thing where the government's saying, you better not hurt somebody. And if you do, we're going to have guys come with guns and put you in a cage where you're going to get raped for 20 years. I mean, that's a weird message to be sending to people.
I definitely agree. And I really liked your short book. I guess it's really a collection of essays that you made into a book, Chaos Theory.
Chaos Theory.
Chaos Theory. Book.
Uh-oh. We got the zombies coming on. Did you bring some zombies with you this cast?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. They usually follow me around. Chaos Theory. And that's online for your listeners if they're interested in this stuff and want to read more about it. So yeah, it's two essays, one on private law and one on private defense, just spelling out how would the society that where the government dissolved and the functions that the government currently provides either disappear if they're not things that ought to be done, or legitimate services get provided by the market. And so that's available. If you just Google Robert Murphy Chaos Theory PDF, the Mises Institute has that up for free now. You can get the whole thing.
Yep. And I wanted to ask a question from one of our hosts that can't make it today. This is a bit more of a technical question. I actually have no idea what he's talking about, so if I'm reading it correctly, it's what do you think about the White Selgin free banking school, and in particular the idea behind the law of adverse clearings as promoting stability in a fractional reserve free banking system?
Okay, yeah, he's talking about Larry White and George Selgin. And the context of this is even among modern Austrian economists, so they oppose the Federal Reserve. They think that central banking is a bad institution. It promotes the business cycle. They understand, they agree with Mises and Hayek that the cause of the business cycle is an artificial expansion of credit that then pushes interest rates below what they should be, that causes an unsustainable boom, and that sets in motion sows the seeds for the bust. Then that's what we call the recession. So they're agreeing with all that stuff. The difference, though, is the followers of Murray Rothbard on this point want to have 100% reserves, meaning that let's say that the money in the society is gold. They're going to say you have to a commercial bank before it gives you a deposit and says, okay, now you have money in your checking account balance, you have to have 100% backing of that in terms of in the vault. Like you have to have 10 ounces of gold in the vault if then the bank's going to give you a debit card. And when you put the debit card in the ATM machine, it says that there's 10 ounces of gold on deposit for you. All right. So that, whereas right now, as you guys know, there's fractional reserve banking where the banks don't have all of your money sitting in a vault with your name on it, that they've lent most of it out to other people. So the Selgin White group of people, and they call themselves free bankers, they say that No, you don't need 100% reserves. It's not fractional reserve banking per se that's bad. It's fractional reserve banking under the guidance and support and the cartelization of the government that's bad. That in a free market, where there's just genuine property rights and law enforcement of enforcing contracts and so on, banks could have fractional reserves as long as the customers all know what's going on and everything, and they actually think that that would be optimal, that they think there would, that it would be more economically efficient. And so there they're saying, what would, you know, a bank, when it's a private commercial bank, when it's deciding, do we want to keep 100% reserves or not, what incentives does it face? Well, if it makes loans to people, like if it takes gold out of the vault and lends it out to somebody, even though the guy who deposited that gold still thinks he could show up at any moment and claim it, so now, you know, they're vulnerable to a bank run. The benefit of doing that is, of course, they can earn more interest now because they got more loans outstanding, so they're earning more interest. The downside is now they're more vulnerable to a bank run. Now it's more likely that its customers will show up and say, hey, we want to take out more gold. And, you know, depending on the contracts, maybe they can say to their customers, well, you have to give us 6 months or something. So, I mean, but then that inconveniences the customer. So there's pros and cons. And their point is just, if one commercial bank is inflating too much, is lending out too much money, then that will quickly come back to bite it, that it'll end up, the deposits will end up with other banks, and then they'll, in clearing transactions, will come up to the first bank and say, hey, we want some of your gold because we have all these tickets that you issued. And so I'm having to collapse it a little bit just to save on time, but they're saying there could be this nice market equilibrium at less than 100% reserves. So my personal take on all that stuff is, I think there'd be a two-tiered system where there would be genuine 100% backed demand deposits, like, so what we would think of as checking accounts or whatever, that the customers would know the bank really is just holding my money for me. It's not lending it out, and it's perfectly safe. There's no such thing as a bank run. And then there would be other types of accounts where technically they were what's called time deposits, and they were like, you were like giving short-term loans to the bank, and then you were earning interest on it, thinking that, yeah, probably on a good day I can just show up and that money will be there for me to take out, but technically it might not be. So I think it would be that kind of system where the people who really do want 100% backing would have that option, but the people who want to earn interest on a very liquid account would also have that option too. So I'm trying to, like, I guess, not take one position or the other, because I think both sides have legitimate things that they're saying. One last thing I'll say, though, is I think the whatever the market equilibrium would be, then it would kind of stick around there. So it's not that there'd be these giant waves of commercial banks inflating and then collapsing and inflating and collapsing. So you'd have this massive business cycle, which is what we have now, that, let's say, the profit maximizing thing were to have reserves of 52% instead of 100%. Okay, but then it would probably be 52% the whole time. And so it would be a stable thing, and you wouldn't have recurring business cycles.
Yeah, and thanks a lot, Bob, for taking on that pretty technical topic. I know our producer, Niren, is going to be pretty enthused. And there's a lot to kind of put into it's a big can of worms to try to tackle, I guess, in other words. One way I've kind of looked at it or thought about it is, or want to give people an analogy, it's like any other price floor or ceiling that the government imposes, you know, just like you have a minimum wage or something like that, or rent control. It's going to skew the market, and like you can kind of say without certainty, or like you just said, there could be a couple of ways that might turn out in the future. We can't predict for certain, but we are at least encouraged to think that without violence, it might go in a good direction. So again, thank you. One segment we wanted to try with you, we've kind of been going to be doing with guests on, is, if you want to entertain us, is Bizarro Mode. And this is where Bizarro Mode is where we go in and we want to see if you've ever tried this before, to make a strong argument against some position that you hold dear. So if you were to kind of play devil's advocate and try to say, you know, for instance, why you might need violence, or just kind of play devil's advocate and kind of debate yourself.
Okay. All right. So I guess I've often thought that it's concerned me. So I'll pretend I could go up to an anarcho-capitalist, like a Rothbardian, and say, you know, you guys, it's so hilarious to see you guys, your movement, that you're just like the Marxists, right? The Marxists, they looked at the world they grew up in, they thought it was unjust, they didn't like it. So what do? They have a bunch of theorists that walk around, they divided the world into these class systems. For them, it was the proletariat versus the capitalists or the bourgeoisie. And that's how they analyzed everything. And that's, you know, no matter what the issue was, they could always break it down to that. Stuff would always become really political to them. You know, whether you're watching a movie, listening to some music, talking about the proper method to raise children, everything always came back to politics for them and the issue of what advances the interests of the proletariat, blah, blah, blah. And then they would have these massive sectarian squabbles where they're all different Marxists. They all, you know, call themselves that. But then you've got, you know, the Bolsheviks over here and the so-and-so over here, and these are the Trotskyites and Stalinites and da, 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 da. And then they and that was their vision. Okay. And so I think, so again, I'm being this critic of the Rothbard and say, don't you guys see that's exactly what you're doing? You just do the same thing. You go around, you have this view of the world, you see this injustice. And so how are you going to solve? You come with these very utopian agendas for how you'd reform things. You divide the world into classes, but for you, it's not proletariat versus bourgeois or capitalist. It's the state versus, you know, the private sector or whatever. And that's how, no matter what the issue is, you go on Facebook and look at the pages of these libertarian types, and no matter what it is, it always comes back to, you know, there's not a topic that can come up and they won't somehow trace it to, oh, government intervention's causing that problem. You know, Avril Lavigne's getting married. Well, that's because of the state. You know, if it weren't for the state, we wouldn't know who it was. You know, and so, and they go through that kind of stuff. And so look what happened in history when the Marxists actually had their ideas implemented. And oops, it didn't quite work out the way that the intellectuals thought it would. So, you know, you nutty Rothbardians, if we actually did get rid of the state or whatever, it wouldn't be this spontaneous utopia you talk about. It would be like it's been throughout history whenever governments have fallen temporarily, like, you know, because of civil war, earthquakes or whatever. You don't see this massive flowering of private defense agencies and everyone's running around so happy about them being free. It's a terrible situation, and that's why the governments get reestablished, and the public is glad that the governments get reestablished because they like living under a state, and that just shows that you guys are crazy. So,
and they like having roads, too.
Roads.
Well,
yeah.
Roads.
So that would be my if I were going to throw a critique at what it is that we're doing.
Yeah, thank you very much for indulging us on our new kind of segment idea. And I know you talked earlier about how you like to, there's different size rooms and different audiences, and you like to kind of get feedback or can be different to play with. But you know, you can't see our producer chat, but we were all kind of, it was all grins. We were all blowing it up like, this is a very interesting direction he's taking it in. So again, thanks for indulging us.
Sure. Yeah. And I think that is a good, I'd be curious to hear your other guests and the kind of things that they would come up with. That's an interesting approach.
Yeah. We have some interesting guests coming on soon. We have, Jeff Tucker, Tom Woods in a couple weeks. Just had Stefan Molyneux on this past Wednesday.
Walter Block's coming on really soon.
Oh yeah. Walter Block's upcoming Wednesday.
Is there anything you want to get a plug in for, Bob? Any books or any events you got coming up?
I would just point people. So I am shamelessly trying to reach my 5,000 limit on Facebook. So my name there is Robert P. Murphy, living in Nashville. So if you want a friend request me, that'd be cool. And my blog is consultingbyrpm.com. So consultingbyrpm.com is where I post, you know, if I'm going to be giving a talk or something somewhere, that's kind of my headquarters. So people, if they want to follow what I'm doing, that's where they should go.
We have a Facebook for the show too. So we'll friend you with our Facebook account and get close to that 5,000.
All right. Every little one helps.
This has been Bob Murphy.
Bob Murphy. Bob. Neo-Confederate.
I think we're getting pretty close to zombie apocalypse here, so we got to end the cast before they break through the cast. And
okay, let me, everybody. You want to help us take us out? So we hope you enjoyed the Sunday show, which airs 6 p.m. Eastern time, barring any technical difficulties. We really enjoyed the conversation with Bob Murphy, and we hope you did too. We welcome you to check out our archives at Decline FM or point your iTunes to Decline Estate. Also, check out some of the great works by Bob Murphy, including Lessons for the Young Economists, Chaos Theory, and the Politically Correct Guide to Capitalism, to name a few. And just like you said,
Politically Incorrect Guide to Capitalism.
Did I say that wrong? Politically Incorrect?
Yeah, you said Politically Correct. Oh, it's not Politically Correct. It's Politically Incorrect.
That's important to know. And as you said, Adam is a friend on Facebook and pledged to see him debate Paul Krugman for charity. Remember, if there's a topic you want to hear discussed on the show this Wednesday, 10 p.m. Eastern time, please submit to r/declinedestate on Reddit. And I would like to remind you that Decline Estate is still brought to you free of charge, as well as paid advertisement free. A big thanks to all of our hosts, tech experts, researchers, contributors, our listeners, and Bob Murphy for being so generous with his weekend time. Decline Estate is a group effort motivated by our love of liberty, as well as capitalist bow ties and free market monocles. So this is Ron McPaul reminded you when asked, always Decline Estate.
Decline Estate.
Decline.
Decline.
This has been Eternal. Take care, everyone.
This has been James Carlin. Take care.
Ron?
Thanks a lot, Bob. Stay black and yellow, guys.
Okay, thanks, guys.
All right, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks so much. And have a good rest of your weekend.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, just send me the link or whenever when this thing is posted.
Sure. Yeah, I'll send it in an email to you.
Okay, great, guys. Thank you.
Have a good night.
Thank you. We'll be right back.